We just like handed the hostel over to him after a couple of months of training. We're just like, we're out. We need a vacation. Like, oh my God. You know, we're talking 80 to 90 hour work weeks, no employees, no weekends, no romance. You know, just like we made the sacrifice just to scale our business. Like long days, no sleep, no, you know, no trips, no vacations. And then we just gave it to Andrew and then did a stress test, right? And then we just went to Thailand and Myanmar and, we came back, didn't burn down, and things worked. Like it went well. And so
Hello, friends and travelers. Thanks for listening. You are riding along on the Hostel Road Trip podcast. Our mission is to spread awareness of the true hostel experience in the Americas and share stories from the fascinating hosts who create those unique facilities. I'm your host, Jimmy Black, joined alongside co-founder of International Travelers House, Bobby Dyer. Each session, we sit down with hostel operators or travel influencers to hear about their road to success, discuss trending hostel topics, and close with tips for travelers who are seeking to have the ultimate experience when visiting each destination. You can't afford to miss this trip. Now fasten your seatbelts and let's hit the road.
Boom! Welcome back to the Hostel Road Trip Podcast. Really excited about today's episode with a hostel legend, a living legend, Frankie Medusa of the Bunk and Brew Hostel in Bend, Oregon. But that's just the beginning of Frankie. And that's just the tip of the iceberg because his journey has been super amazing in so many ways. And he's found himself over in Portugal working on this abroad project. And he's also one of the founding members of the NAHA, the North American Hostel Association. So the biggest question is, how are we going to fit it all into one episode? I don't know. I've been doing push-ups in the corner for the past 10 minutes trying to get jacked up to keep up for it, but let's dive in. I'm with Frankie Medusa and Robert Dyer, my co-founder and partner of IGH Hostels, and we're ready to rock out an awesome episode. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Excited to be here.
Yeah, excited.
All right. So this is our, you know, second attempt. Frankie is a adventurous man, and that's one of the things I've always loved about Frankie is that he never lost the genuine traveler within him, despite having these entrepreneurial ambitions, because a lot of times one devours the other. You know, you've got the traveling gypsy within you, and it never lets your entrepreneurial aspirations come to light. On the flip side, you might be the traveling gypsy, and then all of a sudden your entrepreneurial aspirations start to kill that gypsy. So I love to see that the gypsy still lives inside you, despite all these awesome adventures you're taking and things that you're doing. But tell us where you're at right now in the world.
Yeah, no, thanks. Great. I'm in Portugal right now.
What part of Portugal? Is it Lisbon, Portugal?
I am just north of Lisbon by about 2 hours. I'm in a small town called Tomar, Portugal, and it's actually the Knights Templar headquarters. And I'm still figuring out how to become a Templar. So
okay, that's awesome.
Yeah.
We're behind the scenes project. I like it. Well, but obviously you started Bunk and Brew with Jay. We just recorded an episode with Jay in which we focused a lot on the Bunk and Brew property and the awesome story that you guys had together and how you met in a soccer league and, you know, by chance via a mutual friend and then just, you know, hit it off and had that complement of opposites attract type of thing, you know, and complementing skill sets. And I've always looked at you and Jay as a similar style to Bobby and myself, you know, two guys that respect each other, work well with each other, and understand that each other have different talents that are bringing it to the table. And so I've always been a big fan of your guys, but give us a little bit of a brief story of how you got to the point where you wanted to open up a hostel, and preceding Bunk and Brew. What was your experience or your exposure to hostels that made you want to do this?
Yeah, good points and good questions. Jeez, and I'm really excited to listen to that interview with Jay. I purposely haven't listened to it yet, so this will be great to compare. I think it's interesting. You know, I've mentored some people now to like open hostels, and people reach out, and I think there's the traveler that has traveled the world and just knows they want to own one and be part of one for the rest of their life, and they want to start one. And then there was like me, I was just kind of working to travel and traveling, just getting money to in that corporate grind, that corporate life, and then just travel. Like that was what filled the void for me, was just being enriched by other cultures and experiencing something new outside of my bubble. So it's weird. I never wanted to necessarily own one, but then, like all of us do, we neglect our own backyard. And I was just like, okay, I come to this great state of the Pacific, of Oregon, so the Pacific Northwest. I was a Washington-born native, moved to Oregon in my young 20s for college. And Mother Nature is just on freaking steroids in that area. It is amazing.
Beautiful.
And yeah, it's stunning. And so started to just do a lot more. And I was in Boy Scouts, and so I did a lot when I was younger, but then I just started really doing a lot more and just tapping into the local scenes, and then just discovered Bend. I discovered it for the first time, I think it was like 2015, maybe 14, 15, and just fell in love with it. It was, 3 hours drive from Portland, and I just need to get out of the big city. And I tried to like check into a room, and I think it was like $200, $300 a night at that, even at that time, and everything was full. Like, well, where's the hostel? So I just started doing some research. Nothing, no community, no affordability, nothing inexpensive. So I was like, okay, like something's going on here. So it was kind of like, well, I didn't need to reinvent the wheel. It was just like, if I'm affected personally, I think others are going to be affected. I don't think I'm in the minority here. And so, yeah, so it was just kind of like, what are the next steps to put my life in motion to start a hostel there? It was like, this, it'll be better than the corporate grind of doing all this work for somebody else's gain, right? You go to school for all that stuff, and it's just kind of like, well, I think I've done as much as I needed to do in 5 years. I felt like this is boring, and so why not do something new and fun and adventurous and also enrich other people's lives and kind of check the box of like, okay, I want to move to Bend, but also I need to start a business to make that happen.
That
It
no,
was
that's
really,
all.
it, yeah, it was
Good.
really expensive to move there, so.
Well, you bring up some great points. Right off the bat there, for potential hostel operators out there, one of the great things that we always bring up is if you're willing to live off of the beast and live within the hostel, you can find yourself living in tier one cities that you would never be able to afford, or in situations and neighborhoods in certain cities that you're like, we have an operation in Little Italy, San Diego, which is like a thriving, up and coming, very bougie neighborhood. And smack dab in the middle of it, you still got our Bohemian hostel with the flags out front. And it's pretty funny, as you see all these hippies falling out of that house, and people are like, where did these people come from? And we're like, still holding strong, baby. So
No, I love that.
It's a cool thing in that, but I also think it's, how you found yourself in that, what's in my backyard. There are a lot of places throughout the country that could use a hostel where people wouldn't really think of it. And if you're from there and you're a local, you're that local ambassador already. You're that local champion, and that can be an awesome thing to continue to bring more saturation to the industry. Now, also, so you've got this Bunk and Brew project, and obviously we mentioned earlier that you from there you went on to do so many other things. What I think is really inspiring about your story and Jay's story, or one of the very inspiring things, is you started the hostel, you opened it, you rocked it out, and then it wasn't a prison. A lot of people get concerned, and rightfully so. A lot of small business operators become an inmate to their own business. That is their prison. That is their stuff. I don't get to leave. I don't get to go on vacation. I have to be here all the time. And that's a really scary thing to think of. And I think it stops a lot of people from trying it. And I think you guys are a prime example of that doesn't have to be like that, with the right systems and the right setup and things in the right business model. Clearly, you were able to start that, have that experience, and then you moved on to this Portugal project, which I want to dive into next. But give us a little bit of insight on how you two pulled that off so quickly. You opened it, you were on site, and then you guys were off on the run again in your own directions.
I mean, I remember kind of the early days and first manager, and I think a lot of people don't realize what they get themselves into when they open a hostel. So Jay, as you probably told you, comes from law and corporate background. I come from healthcare, IT, medicine background, and we quit our good jobs and our corporate jobs, and then opened the hostel, and we just turned ourselves into glorified maids and housekeepers, and a bit of pimps and the side on the side. No, in all reality, scrubbing toilets, making beds, cleaning, flipping, right? And you have no money to pay employees. And we're just like, God, like, how long is this going to go on for, right? And so we kind of sat down and just really looked at each other, like, okay, let's, start documenting everything we do, getting your systems down. And so, Jay likes to use that term, if you're hit by a bus, can the business survive without you? And I think a lot of small business owners in America probably would say, if I died, if I walked across the street and was hit by a bus, my business will also fail with me. And that's sad, because, like, small businesses are what makes up America. It runs America, it employs America. And so we started documenting everything, and then we finally came into the money. We're kind of like, after about, right around that year mark, we're like, okay, Jay, we're like, do we pay ourselves, or do we hire somebody to do what we were doing and just kind of like go back from not, from being owner managers to being owners, working on your business, not in your business. And so what's that direction? And so we hired somebody, and as soon as we hired them, we got them trained up, and I think we went to Thailand. Was our first trip together away from the business. It was at like maybe a year and a half mark. It was like a 1.5 month, maybe it was a 2 month trip. We did Thailand and Myanmar, actually, and we just trained this manager up. Great guy, still friends with him to this day. He's actually running a food truck now. His name's Andrew, love him. If you're ever in Bend, gotta eat at his Smashburger food truck. We just like handed the hostel over to him after a couple months of training. We're just like, we're out, we need a vacation. Like, oh my God, we're talking 80 to 90 hour work weeks, no employees, no weekends, no romance, just like we made the sacrifice just to scale our business. Like, long days, no sleep, no trips, no vacations. And then we just gave it to Andrew, and then did a stress test, right? And then we just went to Thailand and Myanmar, and we came back, didn't burn down, and things worked. Like, it went well. And so we probably stayed on site for another year and a half. So I was there for probably about 3 or 4 years. After a couple of years of living with the staff, I did a whole van life build out, and then lived another 2 more years out of my vehicle on site. The dirt bag van life. Jay, he had a romance, traveled abroad. I was a little bit more hands-on on site. He kind of remote a little bit sooner than I did. But then I was able to achieve being fully remote. And I think, going back to that, as business owners that, have their idea, have their baby, their baby's their business, sometimes they just can't let it go. I think us as like entrepreneurs and business owners, we're the risk taker, right? We're the visionary, we're the creative people. But like, ultimately, I didn't go to school for like business. I didn't go to school for tourism and hospitality, which are like degrees that we've hired managers and they have those degrees. Like, I know there's a lot more smarter people out there that could really manage my business better than me. But I just had the guts and the vision and the creativity to like take those steps to like plant that seed and to grow it, and then hopefully like hand it off, right? And to not and to get and achieve that freedom. So
How
yeah.
did you did you ever have the challenge of like being the business owner, leaving, and then having blowback from the staff, like, oh, you're the owner, you should be doing this, or they took, how did you manage that as we battle that with having various different businesses and it's, we've learned better approaches. But did you ever find those challenges or how did you handle some of those?
Good question. I actually remember some of the challenges remotely during COVID before I got back on site. I was traveling, I was remote, things were going into shutdown, lockdown, and a hostel is kind of like a commune in a way. There's a lot of live-in staff and it's a community. And what I didn't realize is there were some conversations that were happening behind closed doors about us and how things should be done prior to our meetings, where the Jay and I would jump on these meetings. And some of them, I just felt like, wow, I just got fed to the wolves, and they just came out swinging, and just the opinions were already made up, and just like it was nasty. And I, you just learn to listen and you learn to take it. But I felt like that was the first realization that there could be, those side conversations happening behind owners and managers' doors, and opinions being drawn going into the meeting, which is really sad for just people to kind of come to conclusions before it's discussed. I think at the end of the day, I think to lead by example is just to have a really solid a path and just stick to that path, but be willing to kind of deviate and just, your staff needs to be heard, but sometimes it might not be in the best interest of the business, and some people might be like a little selfish and want it in their own interest. And so this was all kind of around COVID and running business and shutdowns and occupancy and quarantines, testing and all this stuff. And so, we're trying to navigate with, government guidelines, but we're also trying to survive the pandemic and not be one of the statistics and close our business, right? So there's a big fine line right there. And everybody needs to be heard, and then it's just drop the hammer and just implement, And if you burn some bridges along the way, those people are probably not the ones you want to be like kept around or surrounded by. And we also have found that the one staffs that are like the loudest or the most opinionated, like if you start giving your energy and all of your energy to them, they just kind of consume and take, and then they're gone anyway. They just look for the next best opportunity. And it's like, hey, I really like worked with this person, spent a lot of time to kind of almost cater to them. And then boom, they're gone. So just recognize that as a human instinct, behavior pattern, and just kind of, pick up on those cues, I suppose, so.
That's great, really great advice. And so true in our unique business model of having on-site exchange members in that community feel, and then they can start to make, operation requests that are more so catered to their personal interests or wants or desires. But what you really hit on for me is the time that you can waste going down that rabbit hole with that type of character and personality. And what we learned through the trial and error that you did the same way is that, a lot of those types of characters and personalities are hardwired for this, so that the more you give, the more they're going to take. And then they're just going to drain you out to the point where they're really just going to move on to their next victim at that point.
It's like we do in the shadows, those the energy vampires.
And then you're just left there like, what? Oh my God, I jumped backwards. I made all these different things. I made it almost like a competitive game to meet all of your demands and requests. Mm-hmm. And then poof, that person's gone, never to come back, never to be seen again. And you're left to deal with what's left behind in that situation. So I love that insight that you give, and then also the dropping of the hammer. That's so true in the way of you got to stick to your guns at some point. And there's going to be some spilt milk. You're going to break some eggs to make an omelet type of aspect of things. And there are going to be that type of character that we just talked about is going to probably say some very nasty things about you or the company, and you've just got to keep on rolling, because that's a lot better than the situation of having them linger around for months on end and continuing to drain yours and everyone else's energy. Now, so going through that though, and you lived on site for a couple of years, and I love that, then you went off site into the van life thing. And I encourage everyone to get creative with that, because it's kind of like a step phase, you're inside in the staff room sometimes in the start with it, and then you get your own little room, then you might have a camper offsite, and all of those little changes do make the difference on the way to the point where you can leave and do what you did. And that's such an awesome, feeling to know that you are able to take your hands off the wheel and it still drives forward, in the direction. And it does take a lot of trust, like you brought to point, hiring smart people, knowing that, they've studied the industry and maybe you haven't, and trusting in that, it can really be a rewarding freedom. But what brought you to this point of Portugal? So, you're in Bend, Oregon, and I can see and I can understand, like, for us, it was more so, let's get this thing to the point where we could take our hands off this wheel, let someone else drive it, so we can be opening up in another city in the same state. You're all of a sudden in Bend, Oregon, and somehow find, oh, let me go to Portugal. My guess has always been that it was a woman. What brought you over there?
Good guess, but I came over solo. I didn't know anybody. I actually I knew people only through some hostel conferences, so really distant acquaintances that I just met at like some conferences and stuff. But I knew nobody, and again, traveling I worked to travel the world, and I was kind of always looking for that quality of life and cost of living. That's my scale, and then those are the two buckets, and what goes in those buckets, and that's going to enrich me and make me happy. So is cost of living is pretty obvious. What's your healthcare? What's your insurance? What's your things and quality of life? Do you have those things? Do you have that good access to those? Is it climate? Is it food? Is it cuisine? So security, safety. So cost of living, quality of life. Those are just my scales. You go to Asia and the food's really good, but I'll never speak a tongue language. And the climate, I don't like humidity. Like I could do desert, dry hot, but it kind of gets it separated. Central and South America starts to align. I speak pretty good Spanish, and I love the culture down there, but it's hard to own real estate. There's crime, there's some corruption. I don't know. Is that where I want to like raise a family, live the rest of my days? I don't know. And then you go over to Europe. Well, a lot of places in Europe are pretty expensive. But then you look at the kind of those, I like to call them second world developing. You still have your Spain, your Italy, your Greece, your Croatia, your Portugal. They're very pro-immigration. They need work. They need labor. And, if you step foot outside of, Barcelona, Madrid, or Lisbon and Porto, it's like, okay, you see how people really live, it's different. And that was kind of attracted to me, for opportunity, for cost of living, for healthcare, for crime. And Portugal was just checking all those boxes.
Oh, cool.
And
All right.
it was, and I'm proud to be an American, but I also just kind of figured, when I was hitting about, it was about 30, I was like, I don't think I need to be an American the next, 30 years of my life. That was just kind of like, it was just like, that's my next adventure. Like, I feel like I've done the corporate, done college, done the corporate job, started a small business. Well, wife and kids maybe someday, and move to another country and open up a business in another country. What else can enrich me and, be adventurous, And so yeah, that's kind of what drew me away from the States. And those were the things that I was looking for. And again, Portugal checked those boxes, and that's how I landed here. So, I
That's
land, yeah.
impressive. I mean, it's so much more methodical of a process than I thought. I
There's a
thought
lot to it.
you met some beauty and then chased her across.
Oh,
That's gorgeous, man. Did you have something to add,
well,
Bob, there?
no, yeah, that was a very good way to figure it out. And I think, especially during that
Yeah.
time, during pandemic, everyone's kind of like,
Yeah.
the whole digital nomad culture got built, and
Yep.
people kind of figured like, okay, so I can manage my business, I can work online. Where can I find a place that maybe I want to spend, the second half of my life? And I went through a similar experience, and that brought me down to Mexico after exploring some different places. But I think I was like 6 months behind you at one point. I think you were going to the destinations, and then I would see where you were, and then I went there next to see if that was good on it. I didn't wasn't ready to follow you to Portugal, so I ended up sticking back in Mexico. But yeah, I think a lot of people went through that. And then so you were in Portugal, and then you were like, let me, do I make another hostel? What do I do? Or how did you, what struck your next business move?
So I actually come from a bit of a small farm background, growing up in Washington. We had 15 acres, and I actually made a couple offers on some farmhouses here in Portugal that I was going to open up some wolfing. I was going to look at buildings that were going to be independent, so I'd have my own floor, have some volunteers working on organic farms, some volunteers on top. I was going to get into making wine, the olive oil, the fruit, everything's here. The farms are great, and I was kind of going back to my roots. Well, I had some failed negotiations with that. I sold a house in Portland, had some extra income, and I just started to think a little bit differently. And let's look at some other real estate in this town that I fell in love with, which is Tomar. And I found a beautiful building that is located right next to the train station in a historic town. So amazing walkable distance. You get right off the train, you're there. It is actually part of an EU urban zone, or a small urban growth zone. So there's a lot of funds for restoring or starting a business in this area. I've had meetings with Central Tourism of Portugal for funding, and meetings with the city, and I have my permits all in the pipeline right now. They're probably going to be approved this August. And so yeah, I just kind of went from this like farmhouse kind of idea, pivoted back to, well, what I know best is lodging and hostels and experiences. And so I'm going to actually create a co-living experience. It's not going to be a hostel. There's actually already a hostel here in this town. I think they serve do a great job, just a downtown cute little quaint area. But I'm gonna do private rooms, in-suite baths, a whiskey bar on top that's open to the public, and then I'm gonna do co-working cafe, kind of Pacific Northwest style cafe, ground floor. In Portugal, it's not so common for people to really go to the coffee shops and hang out and post up and work like it is in the U.S. and other maybe other places. They just kind of come, have their food, or they stand at counters, drink their little coffees, little bicas, and espresso, and then kind of on their ways. I kind of want to create this little bit more of a multicultural hub. Of course, I'll have a sauna, I'll have showers, I'll service fan lifers and people coming through. That's what I'm going to create here. It's going to be more of a co-living experience, one would say so, versus
Nice.
hostel. That's yeah, and there's a lot of amazing funding for starting businesses in Portugal. I'm super stoked to tap into that. Some really, really good funding. Grants up to 300,000, some small business loans into the millions with zero interest. I think you just have to have the right project in an urban area. Projects won't qualify for like, Porto or Lisbon, big cities, Madrid, Barcelona, like. But if you go to the outskirts into up and coming towns in some rural areas, there's a lot of funding for rehabilitating buildings and starting small businesses. So tapped into that.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm interested to hear how you kind of learned about that. As we've James and I, we branched out into Mexico as we have a passion for Mexico, and but it's definitely been very challenging getting a business started in another country, a foreign country where you don't speak the language. Like, it's nearly impossible for a gringo to go in there, and just how other countries operate. I've never that I should look at that in Mexico. I've never even thought about trying to get a branch or a loan or a development loan in Mexico, but picking a country that has that is a good idea too. How did you even figure that out that you could get money, and how did you go navigate the Portuguese, speaking the Portuguese?
So I did qualify for a home loan, so using Bunk and Brew, a hostel income. That helped me get my D7 visa. It helped me move to that's a it's kind of known as a retiree visa because most of the people with Social Security and passive income have it, but I have kind of both active and passive income through short-term lodging and also through some investments like stocks or crypto. So there's active and passive income. So that I get the visa was the first step. And then Portugal's they're very friendly with lending. So I just presented my income, my tax statements, gave it to the bank, and they ran it up the ladder to the Bank of Portugal. They slapped some approval on it, and
Wow.
I bought this building in 2022. I've been living out of it while I've been working on designs and permits. I got it a little bit delayed and slowed up because I had to go back to the US, one for visas, but two for some end of life stuff with my father and cancer. But all that's done and over with. And so now I'm back here in Portugal and really pursuing the project and making sure it stays on track. I got like a 2% 30-year fixed rate interest on this building. Interest
Great.
rates are also quite low. I think interest rates might be around 6 to 7% right now in the US. They're like 4% right now in Portugal, like right now as we speak. And Fed rates are coming. They're going to be cut, I think, in September, but also probably a couple times by the end of the year. So rates will come down. Euro rates will probably follow, hopefully. I had a Portuguese friend who actually ended up being the real estate agent. And he was like, hey, like your tourism project, there's tourism funds. Let's go check that out. And his English is very good. Portuguese is really good. And so he was one just to kind of plant that seed. Like, let's do it. Let's set a meeting. You just set these meetings and you go. And there was a whole like business chapter. And it's kind of like small SBA basically, but Portugal version
Yeah.
here. And that's how I got plugged in. And then went to the meetings, had some meetings with the city, had some meetings with them. Got the right emails, keeping them in line, showing them the plans, the projects. They love that I have a past business history that they could reference and lean on. When I walked away from my first meeting, they were basically like, "When are you gonna have approved plans? When can we fund you?" And I was like, "Whoa, hold on! I just thought
Wow.
this was just gonna be
That's great.
like I just was gonna meet and greet and stuff." But it was like, "We're ready!" And I was like, "Holy shit!" And so it almost scared me, but I'm ready. They're ready. I'm stoked. They're stoked. It's a win-win for everybody. So.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Now, with the co-live facility that you're building, how many people will be, based on the plans that you have, what will the occupancy be? How many people?
Yep, if I it'll be seven well, one quarter is going to be staff quarters. I'm doing a penthouse suite on top. It'll be like my penthouse, and then I'll hand it off to the manager eventually.
Jim Cannon would be proud of you.
Good point. We learned that one from Jim. Put the penthouse on top and make it the living quarters. So that's what I'm doing. So I'll have a rooftop bar, dining area, and then my penthouse all on top. And then I'll have two floors of lodging, one main floor, and then one basement. The basement will be like bathhouse, sauna, and also a kitchen and patio. I'm also going to have with the patio a rock wall inside my co-living, so you could get on some top rope and top belay and climb all the way up. So that's going to be pretty
Ah,
cool.
very nice.
In Andalusia in southern Spain and even southern Portugal, they build a lot of the buildings with a patio, which is basically just a circular enclosed space. So the internal rooms will have fresh air and windows. And also when it rains, you have this whole green space that comes through a drain. So hopefully I'll
Oh.
have a water catch system to help recycle water, maybe for flushing. Some European places use rainwater to wash laundry. And then I'll have like I said, the patio, the bar, and everything. So this whole building's kind of got some eco component to it. But those two floors, each floor will have I think a total of I think 50, it'll be 15 rooms with a one bedroom for the managers on top. And so each room will be designed with double beds and ensuite bath and a desk. And so it will be allowed for double occupancy. So I'd say about 30 people on site if there's two people in one room.
Nice.
The initial business idea and plan is to do 1 month minimum reservations, like price points at 1 month, 3, 6, 9, and a year. If I did do a year, I'd probably only do one third of the building. I still want to have a vibe, people coming and going. I don't want everybody just to be 1 year tenants. If I can't sell my occupancy and my beds and my rooms, I'll scale it down to maybe like 2 week minimum reservations. So I'll play with that number. Hopefully it's all 1 month. I like that concept because you need a lot less staff. When everybody's just 1 month and 15 rooms, I might only have maybe one to two checkouts with 15 rooms in 1 month, right? Just depending how everybody's staggered. So who knows? So it's a little bit on the low side, but I think the bar and restaurant and other revenue streams should help offset the cost, like low
Sure,
side and
sure.
occupancy.
Yeah. We did a co-live operation for about over 10 years in San Diego near Balboa Park, and that was a really cool experience of, very much in the hostel theme as we are hostel operators, but it was just now you had long-term residents, and some people lived there 4 or 5 years, and eventually the developer knocked down the whole like city block and is building up these condos. So we shut down that location, but really cool to see that co-living experience based off of like the hostel roots. And I know yours will be the same, so I'll be anxious to come take a look at that place. That sounds awesome.
I'll put you guys up for a month. We'll have a lot of fun.
Is there going to be
Yeah.
a maximum?
A maximum would be 1 year. And
One
so
year, okay.
minimum ideally is 1 month. Maximum stay would be 1 year. And
Okay.
then different price points kind of like on a quarterly system.
What
One
is the
month.
target open date right now? Do you
Ooh,
forecast?
good question. So I think I should have plans end of this winter, so early next year. So that's 2025. Construction will take at least, I think, a year and a half. So I want to hopefully open summer of 2027, I guess, because that'll be 2025. Oh, sorry, summer of 2026 is the
Awesome.
ideal. It'll be like all of 2025 construction, and maybe into early spring of 2026 construction. Summer 2026 is the ideal open date. Fingers crossed, but it's Portugal. It's a Mediterranean lifestyle.
Could
Everything
be
travels a little
2028.
slow.
Who knows?
I'll have a lot more gray hair by then.
Well, I think that's so cool though. It's a good example of if you purchase the real estate and you're able to look at it in that long haul, 30-year pit, long game plan. You have the ability to do what you're doing, as if you were ever leasing a property. You'd be in a situation where you're panicked, you're rushing, you have to get it open, and you find yourself out of business. But it's amazing how if you have the savvy real estate investment like you've got, you can change that whole dynamic by living on site, giving yourself the time necessary to let that project cultivate and run its course without the disruption of it being rushed along, and then you're having to change your vision on the run to accommodate a timeline and a pressure. So that's a really cool example of the advantages of a savvy real estate investment.
Yeah, I think it's always smart to just have equity and leverage your equity. Like, it's a good way to, it's kind of going back to the bunk and brew. If I circle back a little bit, it's, paying the managers more than the owners is what has given us this Jay and I this lifestyle of our freedom. But we've been getting the equity in the buildings, and so once it'll eventually flip, as you scale. But it's been giving us the lifestyle we wanted to have, and it's given us the opportunities we want to chase.
No, that is a really good point. If you have the equity in the building and every month you're gaining that equity by the operation paying for it, then you can justify paying the people who are operating it if you're thousands of miles away to do it well and keep that rolling for you. So that's a great example of that. Now to flip it forward over to the Naha, before we let you go, we definitely want to touch base on this awesome creation that you, Jim, and Jay put together out there in the Pacific Northwest and really have a nice momentum going on what had been attempted in the past, let's say 5 or 10 years. There was a lot of talk of the need for a association for hostels that represented the whole states, and you guys even went a step further to include Canada and Mexico, which I love that. And I think that you've got the best momentum out of the, previous operations that started up in an attempt to do this. And I think you're going about it in a lot of the right ways, and the formation of a board and the process of it, and putting in that time to let it grow and cultivate. But give us a little bit of background and story about how you guys got this started, what it's all about, and what's coming up, new and exciting news for the Naha.
Yeah, great. I mean, it really, I think during COVID, we just all started meeting a lot regularly with Zoom meetings and stuff, because it was like our businesses are closed. Well, let's just like start, networking and meeting. And so that's when a lot of kind of the ideas and momentum started, and then of Naha, and kind of came out of that. And then boom, our businesses, COVID ended, and then the businesses are back open, and everybody got busy for a couple of years just trying to, right their ship again from sinking. And then we picked it back up. We kind of got to a good place again where we could start putting in our own time. I mean, we're right now, nobody's been paid. It's all nonprofit. All the money's staying in the nonprofits, and we're all volunteer based. And so there has been a good amount of work. I'd say Jay, Jim, and Erin with get from Gaslamp Hostel. She has been instrumental. And myself, I kind of want to take my own credit, but I've been enjoying the journey along the way and learning from some of these guys, and doing a big hostel reach out. And I guess they made me chair of membership committee, so I'm trying to onboard people. But I think it was just it, there's power in collective bargaining, and hostels just needed a voice. All these little cities and towns just don't know what we are and how to regulate us, and so we just needed it, and it's long overdue. So now we hope to take on insurance companies. We hope to have great deals with software companies, we have one in place with CloudBeds. We have one in the pipeline for PricePoint. Hopefully more to come. These are all software companies that help run hostels. Hostel World has even helped shown up and did a donation to get the nonprofit started. So that was an amazing instrumental. So we did some fundraising, and geez, with that first conference, I mean, I think we had like what over 100 hostels from around Canada, U.S., and Mexico join. I mean, it blew my mind. I didn't really know how many would come, but I mean, I remember some very late nights of just going through spreadsheets and I guess Google, and just looking up every state and just combing, through any information I could find. And actually, I had a spreadsheet during COVID that I made kind of COVID slash pre-COVID. And then I readdressed that post-COVID to do the reach out for our conference. And wow, I was finding about 50% closure rate of a lot of mom and pop, you know, bed and breakfasts that had bunk beds and some hostels and some hybrid models just around the US that just closed and shut down. It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was sad to the industry. And so I'm stoked. You know, I think Naha, you know, part of it is every year we're gonna have a new location for the conference, you know, whether, you know, West Coast, Central, East Coast of the US, Canada, same thing. North or West and East Coast. I guess it's not a lot in the middle. Mexico as well. I think there's rumor our next conference could be heading south. I don't want to.
Yeah, come on down
yet. But that's the rumors in the street. You know, so it sounds like we're going south for our next conference, and I think that'll be like in April again. So south of the border. Well, So I don't know. You know, I think. You know, we really want to be there for the hostels. We want to be a voice for our members, and just and actually our members will have that's something we took away from the conference, is members will basically vote on driving the nonprofit of what we should tackle and what's most important for them. And that could change every year. So.
Yeah, it's definitely welcome too from the owners. You know, it's cool to have a place where hostel owners can meet up and gather, and because a lot of times, you know, you're working by yourself in this area, you have a partner, you know, but you're at most, you have a partner, you know, and then you're by yourself in your little town. So we've definitely, as a hostel owner, felt the love, and it's been great to see you guys put it all together, and excited to see where we can go from here.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited for it. I mean, I feel like there's people now reaching out to Naha via email and us still directly of just mentoring. They're like, I want to start a hostel at this, that. And so just the other day, I had a couple emails and an hour long phone call with the gals trying to start one up. So eventually they'll become members of the nonprofit, and we'll have a really solid mentorship program in place. And hopefully the mentors are in like the geographically location, you know, to where they're trying to start their project, you know. I think every state is almost represented with hostels, I feel like. So just about.
And that's such a great thing you're doing with that. Again, with the younger people that are starting, or even older, that are starting up a hostel, and you go back to like what's available to that person. Put them in our shoes when we started, and you'd find one book from Vicky, and that was it. You know, and then you go to Darren's website and, you know, hostelmanager.com and you know, read, you know, and read older articles on things, you know, and it was very limited. So I think what you guys have created is like a new 2.0 of that, you know, in real time, you know, like access, mentoring, these really cool conferences. And I really do want to applaud you guys for making it an inclusive process. Like your first ever conference wasn't even a conference. It was just a gathering for ideas on what it should be. You know, and that was a real testament to what you guys were doing and how you were going to drive it, move it forward. And I was very inspired by that. And that's why we always come to those conferences, not only ourselves, but we bring as many people as we can from all of our locations. And it's an amazing time. And I love to hear about you guys exposing or, you know, helping out younger people, new hostel owners getting involved, because that's what it's all about, in the awareness and expanding in the industry, especially in the US where there's so many gaps. But
we really are all in it together, you know. It's like we're not big hotel chains trying to compete for every bed and occupancy. Like, no, there's plenty of piece of the pie. Like, we're in this together.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more people that are aware and that have a positive outlook about the industry, the pie will only get bigger. And, you know, so it shouldn't be a thing that there's only one hostel, like, in each city. You know, there should be a variety. There should be different styles, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and that can cater to a bigger part of the market. But what we need to do is bring better awareness and better positivity and overcome the stigma of, like, those horror films, you know, that within this industry really set us back still to this day. And, you know, so the more that we can all do collectively to overcome that, the bigger the pie will be for everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
But I just want to thank you so much, Frankie, for taking the time to
Yeah.
be with us today and do this awesome recording. And we'll have it up on the website as soon as possible. Yeah, and all the
Thank you. Yeah,
apps
I've
and
already.
podcasts.
That's great. That's great. I've already sent the link to a couple of people that are like, I can't find much content. Like you were talking about the Vicky's book to the hostel management. Like the content just needs to be fresh and updated. So what you guys are doing, it's super fun. It's really awesome to listen to them. And I've already sent the link to a couple young people that want to get into the space. So appreciate you guys.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Appreciate you too, man.
Yeah.
See you in
All right.
April.
Take.
Heck yeah. April.
Yeah.